Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It is week three of the Occupy Wall Street demonstrations in New York, and similar protests have broken out in at least 14 other major cities. Demonstrators are protesting against corporate power and growing economic inequality in America.
This week in Boston, activists and Princeton University professor Cornel West paid a visit to the occupiers in Dewey Square.
Occupy Boston! Occupy Boston! Woo! Let the word go forth here and now that something is happening in Boston. Something's happening in New York. It's happening in Los Angeles. It's happening in Chicago. It's happening in Detroit. It's happening in McAllen. It's happening in towns we don't even know the name of. Give it up for the Democratic Awakening! Is the response of the U.S. Autumn to the Arab Spring.
Response to the U.S. Autumn to the Arab Spring. That's the opinion of Professor Cornel West. But others aren't so sure. The Arab Spring, after all, is a series of popular uprisings that have uprooted three entrenched dictatorships so far. Occupy Boston is about 100 people in tents so far.
On the other hand, the Occupy movement is perhaps the most sustained popular protest from the left since the Women's Liberation Movement in the 1970s, or maybe the anti-Vietnam War protests before that. From the right, more recently, we've seen the Tea Party movement spread nationwide and profoundly influence at least one election cycle.
So for the rest of this hour, we're asking, is popular protest back as a force for social and political change in America? What do you make of Occupy Wall Street or Occupy Boston? Are they effective means of protest and social change? We'd love to hear from you, particularly if you observed or participated in any of these demonstrations in Boston or elsewhere. Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. And joining me now is Sarah Soberai. She's an assistant professor of sociology at Tufts University. Her research focuses on the media, politics, and culture. Her latest book is called Sound Bitten, The Perils of Media-Centered Political Activism. And Sarah Soberai, great to have you.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Thanks for joining us. And also joining us from Northampton, Massachusetts, is Michael Clare. He's the Five Colleges Professor of Peace and World Security Studies and a defense correspondent for The Nation magazine. He's also a former protester from the 60s who participated in the 1968 occupation of the Columbia University campus. Michael Clare, good to have you.
It's a pleasure as well.
So let me start with you, Michael Clare. Paul Krugman began his column yesterday saying we may at long last be seeing the rise of a popular movement that, unlike the Tea Party, is angry at the right people. Do you agree? And do these young people remind you perhaps of yourself a few decades ago?
Well, it certainly does have some feeling about that. I remember the very early days of the anti-Vietnam War movement, and it looked a lot like this. That is to say, very spontaneous, coming unexpectedly, and mushrooming all over the country without any real leadership or any, you know, organized force behind it. Those developed in time, but at first it looked very much like this, spontaneous and without a clear central organization behind it. So I would say, yes, this may very well have that character. We have to see if it has the staying power.
Mm. Sarah Soberai, a question for you, and actually I'd like you both to chime in on this. What sort of got me thinking about this when we began sort of planning this show is this question that occurred to me, and that is, are Americans in general slow to take to the streets relative to other cultures? And I guess I'm asking because, you know, it's been years of reporting on economic inequality. Middle class wages have been flat. Top 1% has been getting richer. Now 1 in 6 Americans living in poverty. I mean, you know, part of me has wondered why protest hasn't broken out long ago. Are we reluctant to take this route compared to, say, European countries who are quick to come to the streets to protest austerity measures, for example? Sarah Soberai, what's your feeling about that?
Well, I'm reluctant to sort of weigh in on the comparative perspective, but I would say that it's easy to forget that there's been a lot of protest activity since the 70s. So mm-hmm. we don't want to forget what happened in Seattle in 1998. Sure. That was certainly not only an act of protest, but really a movement activity, right? This was not just domestic, but transnational, and the global justice movement really was quite active here and abroad at that time. And similarly, even looking back to 2004, there were 500,000 people in New York around the 2004 presidential election or during the Republican National Nominating Convention, which was just tremendous in terms of size, really astounding. Some of the estimates were up to 750,000 at the time, and also really some very large anti-war protests. So I think that part of what happens is because there is not a lot of mainstream media coverage of protest activity, it's easy to forget how many people are out there participating and trying to get their issues heard.
Hmm. And what do you make of that, the fact that there hasn't been a lot of mainstream stream media coverage so far? And specifically looking at the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy Boston. And I ask that because a lot of the coverage that I've seen in these early days seems, I don't know, almost dismissive, treating these folks with a bit of derision, almost mocking them. And that includes even some of the coverage I've heard on NPR, I have to say, frankly. Michael Clare, what do you make of that?
Well, I think that's partly because the media has convinced itself that there isn't a protest movement on the left. I think, you know, the punditry is decided that the only authentic protest movement now is the Tea Party, and they've been covering that with a frenzy for the past 2 years. So I think this is a product of their own misconception and their failure to cover this. Now, whether that represents a deeper prejudice on the part of the mass media to, you know, disrespect the voices from the poor and the unemployed and so on, I think you could go that far as well. I think some really intense investigation of it would probably prove that, but I'm only going on anecdotal evidence here.
Yeah. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, I agree. It's been actually quite fascinating, I think. I think the very early coverage was really slow to emerge, and it was really snotty. I mean, even there was a really noteworthy piece in the New York Times, maybe on the 26th, where it was really mocking the protesters and referring to things like an intellectual vacuum and really not taking them seriously. Much a very sort of familiar in covering protest trope of sort of the carnival sideshow, you know, that this is a local color story. And I think that eventually, I think sort of spurred by sort of the widespread viewing of there were some incidents of police using pepper spray on nonviolent protesters that got some coverage. And I think that there has been a shift. And I think now there's quite a bit of media attention, some of it pretty good and substantive and sort of interested in getting beyond the surface, you know, what they're wearing and whether they've blocked the street and that sort of thing. But in contrast to the Tea Party, their early coverage was much more sustained. I was curious and looked at the Project for Excellence in Journalism does a news coverage index. And during the April 15th tax day protests in 2009, which were sort of the Tea Party's, that was sort of their big event early on, 22% of the news hole on Fox was filled with Tea Party, and 18% of MSNBC and even new media had about 17% of the news hole filled with it. In contrast, looking at Occupy Wall Street last week, The Economy accounted for about 14% of the news hole, and the Occupy Wall Street protests made up only 12% of that 14%. So really, very, very little attention. In fact, the trial of Michael Jackson's doctor got four times as much coverage.
Oh, boy. Listeners, we're talking about the Occupy Wall Street protests and the Occupy Boston protests. These protests have actually sprung up in some of the biggest American cities around the country. Joining me is Sarah Soberai and Michael Clare. What do you think? Give us a call. We're interested in what you make of these protests and whether you think this represents a move back toward popular protests. protest as a force for change in America. Sarah and Michael, I wanted to play a bit of tape and set it up this way. These Occupy demonstrations, they've been, much has been written about this, they've been decentralized, they've been largely leaderless, and they have been criticized for not having a unified message. Last night, we went down to Dewey Square during Occupy Boston's nightly General Assembly meeting, and as you'll hear, they were in the process of developing their objectives and demands and putting together a list similar to the one out of Wall Street from the Wall Street protesters. Here's a clip. It's about a minute long, and it's a window into how this group is governing itself. Let's listen.
Our proposal is to make a document similar to the one that New York has, and that ending corporate personhood is on the list of things that we'd like to see happen. One of many.
Point of process. Oh, no, a friendly amendment.
Friendly amendment. People's mic.
People's mic.
I propose. That we do away with...
With
the corporate personhood discussion. And I put forth on the table... Something that I think we can all...
Get behind.
And that would be.
As our first statement.
That the system is broken. And we need to fix it. And capitalism has failed. Or something along those lines.
So there are some folks from Occupy Boston last night. Michael Clare, what do you hear there when you listen to that tape?
It reminds me very much of the early 1960s when SDS was being born, Students for Democratic Society, and many of the same concerns were being aired. I have to say, a similar feeling that the system was broken. That was the language we used back then. The system was everything, and it was broken, and it had to be replaced. So there is that. But I'm also hearing that there is a ultra emphasis on participatory democracy, another term from the 1960s, where everybody has an equal voice.
And is that a good thing? If you talk about, you know, your question a while back was, can this protest movement sustain itself? Is that going to help it sustain itself?
I think for now it will, because it will give everybody who joins this a sense that they're an equal participant and they're not being shepherded by some self-appointed leader. Now, that's for the short term. I think it's a strength. It's going to create a feeling of participation, of ownership of this. Now, for the staying power is another question. If they do articulate a set of demands and they want Congress to pass them, for that you need something different. There you need a leadership and a structure. And I'm not so sure that that's going to emerge. Mm. We can't see that.
Michael Clare and Sarah Sober, I stand by. We want to get some listeners into this conversation. I think the last time I put the question out, I failed to give the number. 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Dan, who's calling from Dorchester. Hi, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. What's on your mind?
So I am a youth worker in Dorchester, and in the teens I work with are suffering, and their families are suffering tremendously from the economic crisis, as you might imagine, very high levels of unemployment here. And we took a group of them from my youth program to Occupy Boston and kind of created a bit of a teen caucus. It was a group of teens from Dorchester and Roxbury. And they were really, really inspired. And I think that's wonderful. A lot of times they're really down, and is anybody paying attention to their situation and their community? And they saw, you know, hundreds of people paying attention, and, you know, maybe they wouldn't have used the same language as the people down there in the tents, but I think they felt connected to and really inspired.
And Dan, did you get a sense that the folks you took down, the teenagers you took down, would go back or bring that kind of energy back to Dorchester and really engage in this kind of protest?
So I think that's the million-dollar question, and it's a really good one. So again, most of the folks at Occupy Boston were not necessarily from, you know, the neighborhood that we represent. And I think the interesting political question will be to see if we can kind of work in tandem and whether they can kind of reach out to us and we can kind of connect to them. Because I think then, you know, you talk about staying power. If they can connect you know, deeper to the neighborhoods of Boston, I think they can really build more political power. So it's your question is really a timely one.
Dan, thanks for the call. Terrific call. Glad to hear about the work you're doing. Let's take another call. Matt calling from downtown Boston. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's up?
So I was able to witness some of the protests going on in downtown Boston, and a great expression of freedom of speech that we have. And I was walking around trying to figure it out, looking at all the signs, so many different messages. It was really hard for me to figure out what they were trying to say. And I turned to a police officer who was there, and I said, can you figure out what this is about? And he said, I've been here all day trying to figure that out. And I had laughed, and then he said, best I can tell, these guys just want something for nothing. And he laughed. And, you know, so a great blue-collar guy making an observation about a hard-working guy here, just making a looking around and seeing people, you know, wanting something to happen for them.
Right. So, so
not doing it themselves.
Got it, Matt. Thanks so much for the call. Sarah, let me come to you. Matt just mentioned there a lack of a coherent message. How important is that at this point that, you know, at this early stage of a protest movement, that there be a coherent message, a platform, a list of demands, none of which are included yet in this movement?
Well, I think it's tricky. I think on one hand, it depends who's listening. I think for some people listening, what they hear is relatively cohesive, that there is a critique of sort of broad social structural conditions of economic inequality that are taking a variety of tolls. So what may seem unrelated, whether that's inadequate medical care or environmental dangers or job security or the influence of wealth and politics or over the media, are actually in the minds of the people participating really quite related, because they're really about sort of the concerns essentially about the social or human consequences of massive economic inequality. Now, the problem is how the activists are going to make that connect the dots essentially for other people. And that is a challenge that they have to face. And the problem is that it's important, if this is in fact the concern, that it not be reduced to one line item, because that's not really the concern. It's more broad than that. But especially for the caller and for journalists as well, hearing a concrete set of demands is really important for making it intelligible. So it's a challenge. It's a challenge that I don't know is easily resolved.
Interesting. Let's take another call. Vicky is calling from Ipswich. Hi, Vicky.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to take to sort of nuance that question. I mean, I just came back from there. I'm just on my way out. And what struck me about it is that this group of people really does understand that the issues are interrelated and that it's complicated knot. And what they're trying to work out in a very consensus kind of way is the language and the priorities to deal with it. And it maybe ties, too, to this idea of how it's being spread. So the short term, it really does work. And what I think would be interesting to see is if it sustains in this new platform of media and new ways of talking to each other, that if it remains a conversation, and what the job of mainstream media might be right now, to answer your panelists' point, is to talk about it in terms of the fact that it is a conversation, and to maybe get the idea out that it's important to discuss how complicated it is, to recognize that, and then find an agenda from that point of view.
All right, great. Vicky, I really appreciate the call and the thoughts. Michael Clare, I want to pick up on one of the points that Vicky made, and that is, or that she sort of made reference to, and that is the way this conversation is happening. And one of the ways that a lot of these conversations happen these days is with social media. We certainly saw the power of that, for example, in Egypt and Tahrir Square. Can you sort of talk about that, which I know wasn't around when you were a protester back in the 60s, but the organizing power that social media might have in this context?
Well, clearly that's an important factor, that the word is getting around by Facebook and Twitter, and it's getting around very rapidly, and it's spreading to many different layers than ever would have been possible before. I did a little survey in the cafeteria yesterday at my college, at Hampshire College, where I'm based, and everybody knows about this because they're hearing from it on friends from Facebook or one of the other social media. Everybody is buzzing about it, college students. And when I went into Northampton to the protest, I said, how did you hear about this? They heard about it on Facebook. So this really is happening in a new phenomenon.
Sarah Sobrai, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Michael. Go ahead.
No, you go to Sarah. I'll be very interested in her impression.
Yeah, Sarah, I just wanted to ask you about the sort of potential that social media have to keep the sort of fuse lit on a movement like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what feels in a way freshest about what's going on right now is that even around the Seattle protests and certainly by 2004 and during 2008 elections, there were some of these tools available. In 98, it was really just indie media and the IMC centers that were created. But by 2004 and 2008, there were social media tools and Web 2.0 tools, but they weren't being used to their full potential. So they were often used as sort of virtual billboards. So somebody would put up essentially a flyer on MySpace, but they weren't really capitalizing on the interactive potential of these media. And looking, I mean, this is just amazing the way the Occupy Wall Street group has really used such a diverse range from Tumblr. There's a really interesting Tumblr called We Are the 99% that has maybe 600 or 700 posts of different individuals holding a piece of paper in front of their face saying, I'm one of the 99% and here's why. And they may talk about healthcare or medicine or their mortgage, but there's the live streaming, there's Twitter, they're producing Flickr streams that are really giving a lot of information about what's going on to people who aren't fully satisfied by what's available in the news. The challenge is, of course, that those need to be sought out. It's different than something that's going to come across your evening broadcast or your, you know, morning newspaper.
Let's take another call. Nancy is calling from Framingham. Hi, Nancy.
Hi there. I first heard about Occupy Wall Street not on the national media or NPR, but from Boston College Radio. They have a spot called Democracy Now, Democracy Now. And when I heard about what was being planned and what was being happening in Lower Manhattan, I was delighted as one who came of age during the 60s. That is, the decline of my age group started with the assassination of President Kennedy. And I say more strength to them. I hope it becomes a national movement. These young people have expressed my grievances as well against the social inequality, the political morass.
So I got it, Nancy. You're obviously feeling one with those protesters out there, and we're really grateful for the call. Michael, you heard Nancy there talking about getting away from that protest culture of the 60s, right?
Yeah. You know, I wanted to say something earlier, though, in response to the earlier callers, if I may, and come back to what the fragment that you played earlier about what should be the defining call for this movement. And the speaker that you taped said, you know, the system is broken and we need to fix it or replace it. And it seems, and this was, of course, the overriding thought in the 1960s, and it seems to me that this is an overriding thought today. When I ask my students, they all say the same thing. The system isn't working. There are no jobs for them. And talk to older people and they say the same thing. So I'm not quite so worried about the lack of coherence with respect to demands if this notion, which I think is the case, that the system doesn't work anymore and it doesn't matter, Democrats or Republicans, I think this notion will spread.
Well, we'll see if it does, and if it does, we'll be here to talk about it. Michael Clare, thank you so much for joining us. That's Michael Clare. He's the Five Colleges Professor of Peace and World Security Studies. And Sarah Sobrai, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Tufts University, author of Sound Bitten, The Perils of Media-Centered Political Activism. Thank you both so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
My pleasure.